Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus, the Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees, so our broadcast will look a little different today and in the near future as we reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington. We appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, you're welcome to a special edition of Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sali. Today, we'll have a one-on-one candid conversation with the president of Malawi, Dr. Lazarus Chakwera. Let me say this. I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you for the first time on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much. What a privilege it is.
You're most welcome, sir. This is a gift for us because I have been hosting this program since its inception on August 2nd, 2000.
And is that right?
Yes, and you can't believe that you are my first guest. Actually, in a way, after I have hit 20 years of celebrating Straight Talk Africa.
Yes.
So it's really an honor and a privilege.
Well, it's an honor for me. Thank you.
No, you're most welcome. First of all, we know that you have attempted to be president of your country three times. And
yes, sir.
On the third attempt, you made it and won with a huge mandate. What is it like to be president of the Republic of Malawi? How did you feel, for example, when your name was announced that you had won and you'd be the next occupant of State House?
My immediate reaction was to really feel grateful to the Lord that I believed had called me to serve Malawians. And so I raised my hands toward heaven and worshiped, but I was at the same time struck by the fact that this was going to be an opportunity now to really put into practice that which I had been telling Malawians. And so it's a pretty humbling experience at the same time to know that finally it is done, even after a long struggle.
But what is it like to be president of your country at a time when you have to deal, for example, with the coronavirus pandemic?
This is one of the biggest challenges that has, you know, you could say, brought the whole world to its knees. And we are certainly not an exception. This pandemic is wreaking havoc in the economic and socio-political world. And even the cultural setting, disrupting life at every level. And so, you know, issues of leadership at critical moments are such that one feels even coming to the presidency at such a time as this, there must be a good reason, and we should not waste a crisis, but rather find ways in which we can still serve people, maybe more meaningfully than we would in peace times.
What have you done, for example? What sort of measures, significant measures, that your government has taken in order to deal with the COVID-19 situation?
We have appealed to everyone to make sure that We follow basic hygienic rules, washing our hands regularly with soap, making sure that we watch, social distance, and making sure that we wear masks. We are engaging various stakeholders. We have a presidential task force on COVID-19. We have a coordinating office. And we recognize the fact that this pandemic is a multi, shall we say, faceted thing, which involves various ministries, departments, and agencies. We are getting everyone involved, where not only the health sector and who are the biggest players in terms of mitigating this, we want to involve all the others. We have talked with, for example, Afreximbank. I spoke with the president. We have funds that are being made available. I have spoken with Strive Musiwa and about his own offer, because he's an ambassador for the African continent and fighting COVID. And he has personally offered 200 ventilators to be made available, and they will be here in just about a week. And we are doing everything possible in order for us to combat this thing. But you must understand, as a community-oriented society, it is extremely difficult. And then when we have people looking for food on a daily basis because of the subsistence nature of our society, you find that this is extremely difficult. And so what we are emphasizing is the fact that people should take this seriously, wear a mask, and do your marketing in a way that you respect the other person. It's not just about you and what you're looking for. It's about your neighbor. We are also talking about how to restrict in some places where you have clusters of this thing getting out of hand, so that then we shouldn't necessarily put everybody else in danger. And so we're trying to balance saving lives as well as saving the fragile economy that we have. Our fiscus is so fragile. We need to make sure that we can still continue to exist as a nation.
Talking about economic factors, when we talk about social distancing, you are talking about a culture that is essentially an extended one. You are talking essentially about a community that pretty much does most things together. When you think right. about the social economic factors, I remember when I was young, growing up in Uganda, in Africa, I remember, for example, that there are times when we used to find ourselves like six people sleeping in a small room. I remember that we used to drink from the same source. We used to eat sometimes from the same plate or the same basket. And sometimes, really, we used to pretty much wear the same things. How do you, for example, practice social distancing in a situation where the culture and the social economic factors are not environmentally friendly?
I can identify with what you just said, because when I grew up, that's pretty much the setting. And in many of our rural areas, that is still the manner in which we operate. And what we are emphasizing, however, is that in places where this thing has broken out, let us identify, let us isolate, and let us conscientize each other so that in ways like our forefathers and our forebears used to handle issues that would affect the whole community, they had ways of doing that. Right. And so we are saying there is no one way, and we cannot even do this like a Western country would do it or an Eastern country would do it. Let us do it in a way that is African. Let's find solutions as to how best we can handle this. And so the conversation is ongoing because we recognize the fact that we cannot just proscribe just one way and say this is the only way to do it. It has to be a concerted effort. And so we have to sensitize chiefs, we have to sensitize communities, we have to sensitize particular groups of people. And then the cities in which most of this is prevalent, we also have to see how best we can deal with such.
Public health officials advise that you have to be in a position where you have to often clean your hands with soap. They also advise that you have to wear a mask because you have a social contract with your neighbors and other people that you interact with. How do we go about this, especially when you're talking about, again, the social economic factors here? Does the government, for example, step in and provide some of these necessary things to the population?
Yes, I remember even when we were doing our campaigns, we would have soap, we would have buckets, we would have certain PPEs provided for our people in hospitals, private as well as government, own institutions. And so this is something that we have challenged everyone to say, you need to donate something, please do so. And we would go to the villages and donate soaps because we know this is something that's hard to come by the majority of people. And those efforts are still ongoing. We are appealing, even as we speak now, to various groups across the country that are able to produce masks in a way that we'll be making these available for everyone, even as they, as tailors and so forth, are able to make a little bit of money and income as well. So this is going to be an ongoing fight, but we believe it is a winnable fight.
Interesting. What about lockdown? Do you do some lockdown? Have you taken some lockdown measures, for example?
See, the restrictions that have been gazetted, some have said that's a partial lockdown. Others have said, well, you know, why don't you do a lockdown? But a lockdown, as a lockdown is understood, like some countries have undertaken that, there's no way this country can survive that. Like I told you, people look for food on a daily basis. People do not have the amenities that sometimes we talk about in certain settings. Lockdown as a lockdown? No. We need to find other ways of going around this thing rather than a complete lockdown. And so here we are trying to just balance saving lives and making sure that life should also continue.
Do you agree with some people who have suggested that if you carry out a lockdown without an accompanying economic lifeline or economic stimulus, you are likely to trigger even a much more potent virus, which is starvation?
Absolutely. In fact, I have gone on record to say those type of things. And so even now, a lot of people are struggling. A lot of people cannot find even the pay they used to have because certain businesses have been closed, or certain because schools have been closed. And even just recently, I was meeting with representatives of private schools associations, and they render great service, not just the public schools. They render great service to the nation, but they have been rendered almost, you know, without anything, reduced to where people have no income. And so these are some of the things that we have to face. Hunger is a worse situation than COVID-19. And I can also tell you that gains that we have had in other areas in fighting HIV, in fighting tuberculosis, in fighting malaria, these fights should not be set aside as if they are no longer necessary. They are. And so in trying to fight one thing, we shouldn't lose the gains we already have in other areas. People are dying of other problems, and we need to be able to have all of this in a balanced fashion so that people continue with life despite the challenges.
Mr. President, there are reports regarding the issue of teenage pregnancy during this COVID-19 in your country. What specific steps is your government taking to deal with that type of a situation?
We've had problems of this nature all along. They have been hiding because girls have stayed home for several months without going to school. We've had teachers that are champions of this against you know, the sexual problems that young girls get abused or, you know, we have chiefs that are champions of ending early marriages for such. We have people that we are sensitizing now. I've had meetings with various chiefs to say gender-based violence that is also on the increase because people are pretty much forced to stay together in a way. We need to be sure that perpetrators of such, knowing that we have a law that says girls cannot get married until after they're 18. This is all to make sure that they stay in school, but school is not there. And because of levels of poverty, people find there's no other way than even to get your girl married off. And so it is not just because of promiscuity, it is because of poverty. And some parents actually not taking responsibility to watch over their children. And so what we are doing is to both lobby or advocate for people's vigilance, but also make sure that whenever they are just signs that we can have schooling going on, even in places where this has not broken out, let's find ways doing that. And so the task force is engaging communities. As a nation, we are talking to one another and to say, how best can we do this? We want to find solutions, but it is extremely difficult when you have majority young people and majority women, and they are out there, nothing to do. And so that becomes a huge problem.
Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, could you kindly walk us through a day in the life of Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, President of the Republic of Malawi? What time, for example, do you go to bed, and what time do you wake up?
Well, I heard the other day that most African politicians do their business at night. And I'm trying my best not to do that so that I can have sufficient time to rest. You have to do what you have to do. But I try my best to make sure I have 6-7 hours of sleep, whether I go to bed at midnight or, you know, just before midnight. And I wake up in a way that I feel refreshed. I've never had any problems sleeping, and that's one blessing that I'm thankful for. But when I get up, I take my time to just thank God, and then pray through the day in a way, and get my breakfast, go to the office, and then I find I have a pile of memos to go through, some of them extremely important, they needing same-day response almost. And then I have people and groups of people that I have to meet with. And then I'm yet to begin, you know, going out to visit folks and to interact with people because of COVID-19 restrictions. But my day has been extremely busy thus far in terms of interacting with various stakeholders at various levels, in government, outside of government, government departments, or even non-governmental organizations and their leadership, meeting with chiefs. I've had chiefs from the South, I've had chiefs from the North, and meeting with church leaders of various types. So this is basically what occupies my day so far.
So you have heard that most of your colleagues are essentially nocturnal. They work at night.
Well, that's what I find out. But I'm saying I also want to be able to work when my mind is at its best. And then when you're too tired, you can't be making decisions at midnight.
You know, Dr. Chakwera, it is said that one of the definitions of politics is the art of all possibilities. that with politics, you can in fact make the possible impossible, or you can actually make the impossible possible.
That's it.
How do you react to that?
Well, they got some truth to it, but you do not want to restrict yourselves to some of those definitions because you still have to be flexible enough. Sometimes, like they say, think outside of the box or even throw the box altogether away because you don't want to operate definitions, you know, as they go, define or refine or, you know, draw lines where you cannot go beyond that. And so when you're looking at politics as the art of, you know, making possible the impossible making it possible, or, you know, looking at people's expectations and aspirations and how you can manage them, or looking at policies and how they can best serve people's expectations and so forth, you're looking at a variegated or a spectrum or a kaleidoscope of many, many possibilities. And so he is right or she is right, whoever said that, because all of these possibilities can be harnessed to serve people's needs.
You know, it was a former governor of the United States, State of New York, Mario Cuomo, who in the 1980s talked about how politicians, when they are running for office, they do it in poetry. They promise heaven on earth. But that when they get elected and get to the business of governing, that one, they do it in prose. How do you react to that?
That's quite interesting. You know, when you campaign, it's almost like you have an ideal. When you govern, it's like you have the real. Mm-hmm. And then you need to bring the ideal and the real closer together. Mm-hmm. And then you begin to realize that if there is not much distance between the two, you are actually making progress. You shouldn't throw away the ideal. Neither should you act like reality is no longer there. We live in a world where it's not perfect. And because it's not perfect, we need to work on making sure that the ideals we subscribe to, that's where we push for, that's where we strive to achieve. And so you could say, yes, poetry and prose, but life needs both. And because life needs both, you can enjoy the short story in prose just like you enjoy the poetry, which sometimes is painful pleasure.
You know, some of your critics, Mr. President, have said that when you were running for office, you had the luxury, in their words, not mine, of criticizing your predecessor, Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika, that you criticized him for corruption and for nepotism. These same critics say, when they look at your cabinet, for example, in their words, not mine, mm-hmm. your cabinet does not reflect, does not look like Malawi, that you were able to talk the talk, but in fact, you couldn't walk that talk so that the Malawians could walk the walk. How do you react to that?
Well, I'm glad they are able to speak out and they should not be muzzled. They ought to speak out and they ought to point out what they feel is something that perhaps I have not been able to fulfill. I have had some of those criticisms leveled against me, and I've been able to respond where I can respond. I even had someone tell me that all you've been able to do is replace the Lomwe cabinet with the Chewa cabinet. But at the same time, you know, they say that on one hand. On the other hand, they say, but then you brought in ministers from an area of Lomwe section where they didn't even give you much votes, as many votes as the other areas did. So to say that the cabinet doesn't look Malawian, perhaps is an overstatement, which one understands because of the various issues they may want to raise. But every single one of them is a Malawian, and every single one of them represents someone across the country that everybody can identify with. And so on one hand, you understand criticism, which you must always receive with grace, because even if criticism is 99%, you think is not right, you could learn something in order for your next move to be, encouraged or to be informed, rather, by what other people think about certain of the decisions you make. And so I received that criticism, and I have gone ahead to say a cabinet, by the way, is not like when you are elected into office and you stay there for a period of time. That is a given in accordance with the Constitution. A cabinet can be changed anytime. And so you can always then use feedback that people can give you and so forth. So I'm welcome to that criticism, but we must also realize that none is non-Malawian. All are Malawians.
Interesting. Is it true, Mr. President, that you promised Malawians that next time around, when you are putting together a cabinet, you intend to vet that cabinet or the candidates for the position of minister publicly?
What I said was this is a provisional cabinet, and we will see what Malawians say about these. We do have a law that says any cabinet, that's a prerogative of a president. I am wanting to introduce some practices that get people involved in the manner in which we choose officers, including cabinet.
What about the issue of power? You have a constitution that provides for three equal branches of government.
Mm-hmm.
But you seem to think, from what I gather, that the executive, which you head, may probably be a little bit more powerful, that the presidency of Malawi is probably a sort of imperial presidency. And for that, you have offered to surrender some of those powers. Is that true?
There is a law that, defines what the president should do or can do. And you have rightly stated that for checks and balances, the executive is not the only arm of government. You have the legislature, which is parliament, and you have the judiciary. And however, there are certain powers in our constitution that the presidency has, and yet those powers include, I'll give you an example, the appointment of leadership in governance institutions. And obviously, sometimes what happens is, people say this, that you don't bite the finger that feeds you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you find that governance institutions sometimes will feel like they live under intimidation because they're in, under the armpits of the same president who put them there. And they say, how can we then operate independently? So what I am suggesting is that in terms of those that lead governance institutions, let there be another mechanism of putting those people in place so they do not feel that they have to be subservient to the presidency. That is just one example. They are, because there are several powers, really, some of them are cultural. People make a presidency some kind of a demagogue, or some kind of lord so they can worship. We want to make sure that it's not just what you can legislate. It is also that which culturally we must understand that we can destroy the presidency by ascribing to it too much power, where everybody feels like they've got to kneel down to a fellow human being in order for them to have their way. And so that kind of power leads to patronage and to rent-seeking, and it leads to corruption. We must deal with that.
Do you have issues with what some characterize as presidential aura?
Well, I have always had issues. People in office should not be regarded as some kind of god with a small g, of course. No. No. People in leadership are servants. And one of the things that I have gone around the country talking about is that we want to offer a different type of leadership, which would be servanthood, that we are servants of the people. They are the ones who are the bosses. And so in a system sometimes that creates lords and gods, this flies right in the face of the human spirit and its pride. And so we want to make sure that we do not create that kind of aura where a leader cannot be criticized or you are in problems. A leader cannot be advised, you know, for fear that if they don't like your advice, then it's going to be tough on you, or a leader that cannot be ruled against in terms of, for example, a court ruling or an injunction by the court because of a decision a leader made, and then you want to punish them. No, you need to be able to humble oneself and say, how can I best serve? And then how can I even receive criticism and receive correction and then still serve without really getting so hurt as to think that your ego was in trouble. But maybe that ego needs to be in trouble too in order for you to know that you are not a god of some kind. You are a fellow human being serving other human beings who have needs just like you do.
Is there an African leader that has exemplified what you characterize as servant leadership at its best in Africa?
Well, I can think of Nelson Mandela coming close to that. Despite everything else, he was someone who just wanted to serve. And I would like to follow in his footsteps or even trailblaze something that others can say, we want to be servants and not lords.
The Madiba.
Yes, sir.
Is there someone that you would put your fingers on and say, this is someone that was generous enough to lend me his shoulders to climb on so that I could see a little bit further than him or her? Your
yes,
role model.
Throughout my life, I can think of people that have helped me at specific moments. I think of my parents, my father and my mother. They are long gone. They told me stories of how when I was born, because boys that had been born ahead of me had all, you know, died in infancy, and I was born in that context, everyone in the village thought I would go the way of the other children that died in infancy. But my father said, we'll call him Lazarus, just like a biblical Lazarus that came back from the dead.
Yes.
And so they said, he will live. And I have lived. because of their faith. So my parents become the first ones that I rode on their shoulders. But there's been teachers that have believed in me in primary school, in secondary school, even at university. There have been colleagues that I have worked with that have believed in me and spurred me. And so all along my life, even when I came to this particular service in public life as a politician, there's been people that have encouraged me and people that have said, you can do it, even in the face of criticism, because people said, what in the world are you doing, leaving ministry? I says, no, I did not leave ministry. This is ministry to me.
And what about the other name that your parents perhaps first gave you, the indigenous name, Chakwera, which apparently in your national language, Chichewa, means the rising one?
Yes. So that also is kind of prophetic, because Lazarus is the raised one, but Chakwera means it has risen, or it is rising.
Rising.
Yeah, so it's very interesting that you can mention that, Jacob, because sometimes we never think about these things, but that is a family name that truly is symbolic of exactly what is happening, not just to Malawi as a nation, to Africa as a continent, but to everyone that believes that we can be more than what we are now.
If you were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your Lilongwe heart and soul. Did you at any one time when you were growing up imagine that you would in fact follow the footsteps of the Malawian founding president, Dr. Hastings Kamuzu Banda, the Wamuyaya, the Nguwazi, and become president, given your name?
Perhaps. it is quite a privilege, because the Nguwazi you referred to, the Wamuyaya, was in a class of his own. And, you know, when we grew up and looked up to him as a hero, a liberator, someone that would challenge the white man and call, you know, their former government a stupid federation. You know, we were excited, but in our own little ways, even in primary school, we would be recognized, you know, as a leader in secondary school, at university, all along. And perhaps not necessarily as president, but you always were confronted with situations in which you want to do something about some plight. And you ended up in a leadership position because of that kind of service. And so one would say yes and no. There have been specific times when I failed. Led, because I am a believer. I'm a faith person, and I believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and he leads me, he talks with me, I read through the scriptures, and there's been moments when I have failed, led to do what I'm doing. At that time, I didn't quite fully understand what, you know, he may have meant, but now I understand, and so I'm where I am today, because of some of that revelation. But then looking back, when you hear from my folks in the village and you hear about stories my father used to tell, then you seem to understand that there was something that some people knew about what I would become that was not revealed to me.
Very interesting. You know, There is a saying that all of life is about passion, action, and reaction. And that to ignore the passion, action, and reaction of your time or generation is to risk having not really lived at all, occupying space.
I like that. Passion, action, and reaction.
Yes, indeed.
That pretty much sums up because, you know, if you don't have that passion, and if you don't let your passion be translated into action, or if you don't respond to certain things that, you know, are not right, in order for you to react in a positive fashion, mm-hmm. Your life becomes meaningless. And I think the human condition is such that we are led in different ways to make sure that the passion we pursue, passion that leads us into certain action, should be that which, even when we react, should be that which makes human beings better than they were, or even your own life better than it was. If it is passion and action and reaction that destroys people, that maligns people, or that reduces others as, you know, as if they were nothing, then it is a misplaced passion. It is a misplaced action, and it is a wrong reaction.
What would you say is the single most important thing that you used to do before becoming president that you miss most?
you know, I'm a free mind, a free thinker, and I like my freedom. I like to walk the streets. I like to just talk with anybody and everybody. But you find that the presidency becomes kind of restrictive. So you are not able to do those kind of things. Even when you love sport, and you just can't do it the way you used to do. But that comes with a price, because we wanted to serve, and service does become sacrifice in many ways because of the restrictions that you gladly bear so that you could become more meaningful in someone's life.
So what would you say about a Chinese saying that men dread fame, just like a pig dreads fattening, for both could be a prelude to slaughter?
Well, you know, some of these sayings do become essential warnings so that you do not necessarily become something that your adverts say. You don't believe in your own advertisement. You don't let success get to your head. You don't want your ego to be so big until it becomes your downfall. I think that is to warn all of us that there are limits, and that this life has a place where, you know, it never goes on the way you always think it should. And so we should be humble. And to me, that saying is a reminder that I'm only human, and I should never think that just being president makes you so famous as to want to do anything you want and say anything you want, but to still remember you are but a servant.
Let us talk about the vision thing.
Mm-hmm.
What is your vision for Malawi?
My vision for Malawi is a Malawi that has gotten out of persistent hunger, persistent poverty, a Malawi that has educated children, is a middle income country, able to feed itself and able to export its produce and able to thrive and not just survive because of subsistence farming, but that even issues of farming can become businesses that farmers thrive on. And so I'm looking to a Malawi that is not the third from the bottom of the poorest nations of the world. I'm looking at a Malawi that is prosperous, a Malawi that is united, a Malawi that is served by leaders who do not plunder it, and a Malawi that is ruled because it follows the rule of law, and therefore a Malawi that becomes a heaven for every generation.
When you talk about the rule of law, what about if, in fact, the law has the effect of undermining democracy?
Then that law needs to be changed. The law is meant to serve people. The law is meant to make sure that people advance. So in democratic values, in terms of what people are capable of becoming, the law should facilitate that, not the other way around.
When a president is elected by the people, the president swears an oath into office, and he or she swears to protect, defend, and preserve the Constitution.
Right.
Would you, under any circumstances, support efforts to bring about a shifting of constitutional political change in your country in order for you, for example, to get what is popularly known as a third term? And some, in fact, say, call it a third term.
Because in many cases, it has been viewed as a pursuit for personal profit by politicians who are looking to, feed their ego more than feed the people. And so, yes, you swear to protect, preserve, and defend the Constitution. And the Constitution presently does state certain limitations on the presidency, for example, and I intend to abide by that Constitution. You must remember that we spoke about Wamuyaya a while ago, and we had to change that. The people changed that. And so the people do not want to go back there. And whether you're looking for a third sad term or not, we must remember what the people want. And the people decided, and you serve the people and their wishes.
What if some of your supporters came to you and suggested, just like elsewhere on the continent, that you happen to be a uniquely gifted individual, that Malawi, the Republic of Malawi, probably could not in fact do without? How do you respond to that?
I've been there. I've been a leader of the church in the country, nationally, in Africa, continentally, and the world, you could say. And there are moments people tell you you are indispensable. No, that's not true. No one is indispensable. the moment you, for example, when I left the church as its leader, we used to have elections. People told me at one time, why do you bother with the elections? Just be a father and founder like so many others. And I said, no, I don't do that. That's not what I believe in. And so I have seen it there. And they would say, oh, no, you stay forever. Nobody stays forever. Nobody is that indispensable. I have learned to empower people. Now I'm so happy. People that I taught at every level, even on the doctoral level, are my leaders. And I'm happy to sit under their leadership. And so, no, let's not believe in that fallacy. No one is indispensable.
What would you say is the single most important decision that you have made during your public service? And what would you also say is the single most regrettable decision that you have made during that same period?
I would say that the single most important decision in terms of even, you know, you look backwards and you see, here I am as president of this nation, is the decision that I made last year to challenge the election result and say, I will not accept it. I will go to court. And so, on the other hand, you know, in 2014, I made the decision that I would give whoever had won or had been declared a winner the benefit of doubt and let them do what they can do, despite the fact that I knew things hadn't been right. And then when you look back and you see the plunder and you see people that have died because of lack of medicines in our hospitals, and you see a whole lot of things that have transpired that you wish had been different, then you begin to say, did I make a wrong decision? But sometimes, like Gorbachev said, history dislikes ifs, because you cannot change your past. You must fashion the future.
On that note, sir, it was a pleasure, an honor, and a privilege to have had this opportunity to host you for the first time on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Well, it's an honor for me, and thank you so much for according it to me. And it's been what a joy it has been talking with you. I hope we can do the same in future.
The feeling is mutual, sir. Our distinguished guest is Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, the President of the Republic of Malawi. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. And in the meantime, get better, not bitter, Malawi. And please, please, please remember to keep the African hopes alive.